Introducing Thomas Holt, Associate Professor at Michigan State University.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate it. Thank you for coming during lunch. I know this is always a hard thing to do, so hopefully you've got a beer or some liquid food with you to enjoy. So we'll get started. Today, what I'm going to talk about are stolen data markets. This is something some of you probably have some familiarity with already. Raise your hand if you've heard about mass data breaches. I would think everybody. Good. Anybody had their card reissued this year? I'm working on my fourth card this year. Thanks in part to the fact that I have a 9-month-old who requires all kinds of stuff. So between going to Target and going out to eat, we've lost many a card this year. So mass data breaches have become a big problem in my personal life as well as professionally. What I'm going to talk about today is some research that we conducted that was funded through the National Institute of Justice. So if you're wondering what this little thing at the bottom is, this is a direct result of our funding agency. So, just as a point of clarification, this research was funded by the National Institute of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, and everything that I'm going to talk about today is in no way a reflection of the attitudes, opinions, or what have you of the Department of Justice in and of itself. With that caveat out of the way, we'll jump into the fun stuff. In thinking about data breaches from an academic point of view, there's been a good deal of research that's started to come out. Most of it has looked at one of two angles, either the IRC communications that go on or through forum data sets. And in thinking about the IRC data, this is good, but there are some substantial limits. The same is true with regard to forum data. It seems as though forums are becoming a little bit more of a popular medium for individuals to sell data that's acquired through mass breaches, but the limits across all of these data sets are quite substantial, and we have to give some consideration to that. When we think about who is selling data, one of the biggest dilemmas that emerges is the fact that the communications typically take place in Cyrillic or, to a certain extent, English language communications. If we're talking about Cyrillic-based languages, are the researchers native Russian speakers? Do they understand it? Or are they using machine translation? If you've ever used Google Translate, you know that the translations are adequate, sometimes very poor. And so that's going to have a direct impact on what it is that we're studying. Most of them are based off of very small samples. It could be maybe 2 to 4 forums. Some people have started to just use single IRC sets. And a small number of researchers have begun to use dead forums. So groups like the Shadow Crew, the Grifters, the Dark Market data sets, and analyzing those. It's very helpful, but if we're talking about a group that was active 5 to 10 years ago, what is that really going to tell us about the processes of the market as it exists now? So, one of the biggest issues that emerges within this whole round of research is the fact that very few people have tried to assess anything with regard to the economics of the markets themselves. Only 2 studies have even published information about the basic pricing for data. So if we're talking about a credit card number, a debit card number, how much is it going for? That information is largely absent from the empirical research. And the same is true with regard to organizational issues. Are we talking about a complex kind of mafiosa organized crime network, or are we talking about something that's more distributed, more of a network of colleagues rather than something that's very, very sophisticated? And in thinking about the data markets themselves, there's some good theoretical research from Hurley and Florencio and Wehinger who talk about the idea of these markets being lemon markets. Basically, prices vary and what you pay directly impacts what you get. It's the same with buying a bad car from a car lot. If you buy a car for $1,000 and it breaks down as soon as you drive out of the lot, that's a direct expense that you incur. You might have gotten the car cheaply, but it stopped working on you almost immediately. The same could be true with data markets. If we're looking at information from English language forums where people are untrustworthy and there's lots of complaints, the fact that they're selling data for $5 a lot doesn't tell us much because all of that data might be inactive or old or invalid, and it's not a true reflection of what it is that we're seeing. And so there's an argument that there are multiple markets operating. There's a lower barrier to entry for English language forums and ones that are open. If we were to Google stolen data market CVV dump, the first couple of results that we get would be these types of markets where there's no barrier to entry and you probably can't trust what's being sold. there's a deeper secondary market that exists where we might expect higher prices, greater trust, and greater insularity. And as a result, those may be a more accurate reflection of the market in and of itself. But very few people have tried to address these questions empirically. Instead, we wind up with this sort of question, what do the markets look like? And so that's the point of today's study, today's research, and today's presentation, to talk about what the conditions are like within the market. What are the costs for goods and services? What's the organization of the market? And then what are the structures like between participants? How do they know one another? How do they relate to one another? And to do this, we collected a set of posts and threads from 13 active forums. We oversampled on Russian language groups, and we tried to capture a range of entities operating worldwide. We have a number of them operating out of Russia. We have some in Germany, one in the UK, one in the Netherlands, a few in the US, and we have one isolate that was located in the British Virgin Islands, but communicated in Russian. So just thinking about the hosting in and of itself is kind of a misnomer. It at least gives us a sense of where the sites operate. But the language is more important. If we're talking about a site in the British Virgin Islands where everyone's communicating in Russian, it's unlikely those are the actual residents participating. Instead, it might be that we're thinking about Russians, Eastern Europeans, or emigrated individuals in the US, or those who are maybe using Google Translate to talk. And we captured a number of threads from each of the forums, and we tried to oversample on time frames. We've got data going back to 2007 in four of our forums, and some going back to 2008. Our data collection in and of itself stops around 2011 or 2012, depending, as we had to collect all of it and then have it analyzed and translated. We worked with a certified Russian translator to get the exchanges as they appeared and as close an approximation to English as is possible, because unfortunately I don't speak Russian. My colleague for this study, Dr. Smirnova, who unfortunately can't be here, she's in Russia right now, is a native Russian, and her assistance was great in getting the project off the ground. The reason that we have both English and Russian language groups in our sample is because we wanted to get at this question, the Hurley and Florencio lemon market argument. What does an English language market look like relative to a Russian one? And can we find any evidence of differences in terms of products, resources, or organizational dynamics within the market based on language? So that's the rationale for this study. In thinking strategically about what is sold, we conducted an economic analysis that I'll go through in just a few minutes, breaking out products by specific purpose. Most of the data in our set involved advertisements for data sales. So we have a range of things like dumps. If you're familiar with the term dump, it just refers to a lot of personal information associated with either a credit card or a debit card. Some individuals selling CVVs, that's the three-digit security code on the back of the card, along with the attendant information. A very small proportion selling fulls, and fulls are all the information associated with an account, including social security number, address, and other pertinent information that would allow an individual to take over the account. And some people selling eBay, PayPal accounts, personal information, whether it's email, usernames, and passwords, and then other financial products generally. In case you're wondering, no, we did not see any medical data in here, nor did we see stocks or other types of financial products of that nature. Instead, it's all mostly involving financial institutions, banks, and credit card agencies. But we also had a number of individuals selling data manipulation tools. And this might be cash out services, so people who can go to ATMs and directly withdraw cash from illegally acquired accounts. Some people who offer drops, where if you buy goods online, you have them shipped to a specific location and left via UPS or FedEx, and then those products are either pawned, fenced, or perhaps just shipped on as they are to another person. So it's an intermediary for receiving goods. And a small number who would do money transfers. So if you had illicitly acquired accounts, you could have someone launder those funds on your behalf. And a small number offering personal identity documents. So say if you needed a credit report or credit history or something else, they would be the individuals to go to. And then at a very, very small amount of sellers, we saw people offering associated services, things that you could use in order to either manipulate data on the back end or acquire it on the front end. A very small number of people sold skimmers. If you're familiar with a skimmer, that's a device that you clip onto an ATM or a gas station terminal, or even they make belt models that you can attach where you swipe the card and it captures the track data on the magnetic strip at the back of the card. But that's a very small proportion of what we see. About 84% of all of our ads involved data sales of some type. Moving from the economy, we're also going to look at this from an organizational perspective. And we use a sociological framework, which is admittedly a little bit different from maybe what you're used to. In this case, we tried to understand how people operate based on how they work together, how they communicate, and then in turn, how long they exist. This gives us a framework for analysis that isn't just, are they like a Yakuza or a mafia or flat, but instead tries to assess the groups based on different conditions. How long they operate, what kind of division of labor is present? Do you have someone who's a distinct coder, another person who receives goods? So is there any kind of specialized labor force operating? Do they offend together? That's the issue of mutual participation. And then mutual association. How do they get along? There are some types of crime where you don't have to know the person. With regard to, say, prostitution, always a hot button issue in Las Vegas, you don't have to know a sex worker, you don't have to know anybody, you just have to go, solicit, you do your business, everybody leaves. There's no other connections that are necessary. We want to know what types of relationships are we seeing in these markets for stolen data. And then finally, depending on time, I'll hopefully get to this, we also conducted a network analysis. So if you're familiar with network analyses, these are ways to statistically connect individuals within a market. This sociograph here represents participants in one of our boards, and you can see that we've got a small number of groups that are connected or a small number of individuals who are connected, like say here, you've got one person who's a seller with multiple people talking to that seller, trying to see what they can buy, what they can get. And then we have a number of isolates here at the bottom. These are people who no one talked to for one reason or another. This is important if we're thinking about targeting groups. How do you disrupt a network if they're loosely connected? It's a lot different than how you might if there's a hierarchical structure in place. So this is a very important way to think about connectivity. So let's start with the important stuff. How does the market operate? What I'll talk about now relates to both social organization and economics. If you're not familiar with how these markets actually operate, it starts when someone posts an ad. This is an ad, for instance, for dumps. And I realize this is kind of small, but I'll hit the high notes for you. This person is selling dumps, stolen credit card numbers obtained from around the world. You can see they're offering US data. A classic or a standard card is $20, a gold or platinum card is $25, a signature corporate card is $30, and an American Express card is $20. Any Amex holders in the room? No? And then Canadian dumps. Interestingly, Canadian data is a little bit more expensive. $50 for a classic or standard card, and $70 to $200 depending on what type of advanced data you want from there. And then getting into European markets and places where chip-in-pin encryption is used, you can see the prices are even higher. This is important to note. Every ad typically incorporates information about pricing structures and the quality or quantity of data that's available. They piece it out by product and by type. They also explain their conditions for sales. Since vendors have the ability to advertise and direct their traffic, they can explain in very crystal clear terms how you and the seller are going to interact. In this case, the person explains how they do business. You contact them, you choose the one ICQ number that you want to use, you calculate the total price for what you want, and then submit your order. You send us your money and your email. Now, how's that for a bum deal? Send money first, then we'll send you product. This is very different than, say, a drug transaction or other types of illicit markets in the real world where product and payment can be exchanged near simultaneously or within relative close proximity. Instead, this seller is saying, you send me money, and then within 24 hours, we'll complete your order. In this case, Liberty Reserve payments are what they prefer. Anybody heard of Liberty Reserve before? If you've heard of Liberty Reserve, they were recently taken out as part of a large-scale law enforcement investigation in the US. This payment venue no longer exists, but online currency systems like Liberty Reserve are the preference for individuals in this marketplace. We didn't see anybody using Bitcoin, in case you're curious, or other types of cryptocurrencies, but these individuals seem to be tailored more towards kind of immediate transfers of payments. There's an interesting point here as well, point five. We replace only pickup or hold call dumps within a 24-hour period. What that means is if you bought, say, 100 cards from this person and 90 of them worked, and 10 of them come back as either invalid, inactive, or held, they are no longer active cards, you can contact the seller and say, I need these 10 cards replaced, and they will do so. That's a degree of customer support that they're willing to offer. Since this is... I know this is going to sound really crazy. Just wait, it'll get even weirder, I promise. Customer service is an important venue within these marketplaces to generate attention to your business. You want people to come back and buy from you on a consistent basis. Offer them something. Give them a reason to come back to you. So, this individual, for instance, offers free replacements. There are other types of customer service that are out there. This is a good example of that. A person selling eBay and PayPal accounts from the US and the UK. You can see the pricing structure here is pretty low. If you want an unverified account with a credit card number, it's 1 WMZ or LR. That means Web Money US, Z is the US designation, or $1 Liberty Reserve. If you want an unverified account attached to a bank account, that's also a dollar. If you want a verified PayPal account with a credit card number that's confirmed, that's $3. Anybody have a confirmed account? A couple of you? That's pretty cheap when we're thinking about what you could do with this. We also have accounts with email, just ask. The seller is not responsible for security measures. We check all the accounts manually prior to giving them to you, and you'll also get a clean SOX 5 proxy. The rationale being, if you're, say, an individual living in Europe, but you're trying to use a US account, if it's clear that the traffic is coming from Romania, you're not going to be able to use the account. They will give you a proxy for the associated country. If you burn that proxy, it's on you, as they say here. Seller is not responsible for the unsuccessful usage of the account. You burn the proxy, you got to get another one. If you screw up using this account, that's your problem. They're offering a modicum of support, but nothing too fancy. And this is the type of communication that each individual can specify. Vendors can control the market based on what they feel is relevant. And a final example here, this is an individual offering money laundering services. They say that they work specifically within the Russian Federation. They will work to encash funds, they'll transmit electronic funds, they divert accounts, they work with dirty funds, and the advantage of working with them, low commission. With regard to customer service, they're going to take a portion of the amount of money. If, say, there's $1,000 being laundered, they'll take between 10 and 20% as you dictate the terms and work out the relationship. And speed. As a rule, funds are received on the day that they are credited to the company's account, on the next day or a maximum of one day after crediting them. So, you want your money quickly, work with us. We turn things around fast. This idea of customer service is very, very interesting and very unique to these markets. Just to give you a quick sense of how products are priced, this is a breakout of our product pricing. Let's go with dumps because that's kind of a very common item that's sold. The lowest price dump we saw was 4 cents, the highest was $8,000. Gives us an average of $102.60. We also saw CVVs going for between $1 and $8,000, but the average being 26. We saw the majority of information about pricing going toward our data products. But data manipulation services varied, and largely it was because individuals would list percentages rather than total amounts. The reason being, if you're laundering money on someone's behalf or working as a cash out team, it's going to be easier to take a proportion of those funds than to have a set rate in advance. Instead, it works out for everyone to take a little bit of a difference in terms of payment. We'll return to the economic bit in just a moment. In the meantime, what I want to do is move on to a specific idea about quality and quantity of services. These are the products that are sold in our markets based on the top 10. If we include all the forms in our sample, the majority of products sold are dumps and CVVs. But since any individual can enter this market, and there's this potential for lemon markets where people are going to rip you off, we had a number of complaints in two of our forums, and so we designated them as ripping forums, places where if you go there to buy data, you're going to get ripped off. And that's a common term that's used within the marketplace itself. If you're a ripper, you're a bad guy. We don't want to work with you. We just want to deal with people who are going to get us our money, get us our data, and everybody makes a profit. So you want to avoid ripoff artists. When you exclude two of the ripping forums from our data set, the proportion of products changes dramatically. Dumps are still number one, but CVVs fall out completely. Instead, cash out services become more prevalent. Other products, these could be consumer equipment, these could be different resources like Steam accounts or other products. Malware jumps up quite a bit, dedicated hosting services drops, and then eBay and PayPal jumps up to number eight when it's not even part of the top 10 when all forums are included. So there are some differences when we think about the products and the quality of sellers within any given market. Just to continue with the idea of dumps for a moment. Given that dumps can come from anywhere, we ran a quick analysis to see what are the pricing differentials by country. Given that the US was one of the most prevalent countries in our data set for dumps, we tried to see what the average price was and how pricing differs by country. So we took a logged price for each specific item to remove some of the variation in prices, and then separated them by either Asia, US, Canada, or different regions, and then compared the two. And what's interesting to note is that US data for dumps was cheaper than other countries, same for the UK, and even Canada to a certain extent. These are statistically significant differences. That means if you're going to buy data from a given country, that from the US and the UK are going to be cheaper than all other countries. If you think about the quantity of mass data breaches we've had in the last few years, that might be part of it because the market's been flooded by data from these nations. Plus, we also have lower standards for security and for use of payment mechanisms. So there are some real variations that are evident. Moving from products, let's stick with the sales process itself. So an ad goes up. Once the ad goes up, the individual contacts the buyer that they're interested in working with, and all the sales that take place happen outside of the forum. This is really important because it makes it hard for us to understand how much the final price is for any given bit of data. And that's part of why these limits are present in a lot of the research that's out there. What an advertised price is could be radically different from what a person pays. Generally, we know that all the exchanges are going to take place through either email or ICQ, ICQ being about 50% of the preferred mechanisms for contact. And the various payment systems that we saw were electronic primarily, like Liberty Reserve or Web Money. But we also saw a proportion accepting Western Union and MoneyGram. Some sellers that accepted Western Union payments ratcheted up the price by 10 to 20%. The rationale being they had to have an intermediary work with them or in some way have someone physically show up to a location to get cash. So it made it somewhat harder. There's another point here, and it's the one at the bottom, escrow payments. This was also offered, but at a very small percentage and only within a few of the forums. Escrow payments were present for those boards that had a good degree of organization and had a lot of trust between the participants. This is an example of a grantor service, and they explain why to use them. The grantor of a forum has been created so that you'll not be deceived. By conducting a transaction through a grantor, you know who you can trust. Here's the terms. The buyer and the seller reach an agreement working through a grantor, someone who's been specifically designated by that forum as the grantor agent. The buyer contacts the seller, and using the grantor, they get in touch via ICQ. One of the parties gives money to the grantor and the other the goods. So this third party holds both in reserve. Once the money's there and the data is sent or whatever it is that the person's negotiated, each individual party gets what they've paid for. In this case, data to the buyer, money to the seller. And that gives a way to ensure everybody's happy. Otherwise, you don't know who you're working with or who you can trust. As a result, grantors are there to ensure everyone gets what they want. And grantors also get a little bit of a taste. You can see grantor services are free for up to $30, but once you go over $500, they take 8%. But it's prorated from there. So the more you buy, the less you have to pay the grantor for their assistance. This idea of trust is really important, and it's very odd to think about when we talk about illicit markets because we don't traditionally think of thieves having a lot of honor or trust. But within these markets, that's the way that people get things done. In fact, since sales take place out of the forum, it's hard to know how an exchange goes. And that's why individuals offer feedback. If you buy something from someone, there is a reasonable expectation that you're going to go back into the forum, into that person's thread and explain how it worked, how it went, and what you thought of the data and services. That way, the seller can validate their reputation. People can know that this person is somebody you want to work with. And the buyers can demonstrate how things went. So it's a way to be open and transparent in the marketplace. This is just one example of some feedback that was provided. This went to a money launderer services. They said the thread starter laundered $300. The speed's comparable to the second cosmic speed. Everything was magnificent. I'll go back. The next person, I did some laundering of money from a female partner. Everything was quick and excellent, and they take a small percentage, which makes somebody happy. Now you can imagine if you were working through Amazon or eBay, this kind of feedback is what you'd want to see from a reliable vendor. It's the exact same thing here. And this leads to an important thing to consider. Negative feedback has the same sort of role in the marketplace. If you don't think you can trust a person, read their feedback. If it's negative, you don't want to work with that vendor. In this case, this is a good example of negative feedback. A person asked, has your service been tested or vouched? How do we know that we can trust you? I can provide potential business for you if I can trust you. The next person says he's a ripper. Don't believe him. He says his drops are from Florida. The seller comes back in and says, I'm no ripper. I've never had a complaint. This guy's just trying to cause trouble. I've never dealt with him before. Moderator, please ban him. He's just trying to disrupt my transaction. Next person says, I've contacted him on another forum. I asked him if he accepts escrow for grantee. Of course, he refused. This guy won't work with a guarantor. I don't think we can trust him. The negative feedback that a person gets, if it starts to stack up, can actually lead them to be completely blocked from a forum. Moderators and individuals who are engaging in transactions don't want to deal with people who are just messing around. They want their money, they want their products, and they want a successful outcome. This is as much a legitimate business using certain business practices like customer service in order to get people to use illegal products, engage in identity theft, and cybercrime. And so this is an important issue. When we think about organization, we've got a participatory experience with regard to transactions. Buyers and sellers interact. Buyers get the potential to give everyone feedback through the use of the positive or negative reviews. That affects the way that sellers are perceived in the market. But this also creates an additional layer of complexity. Not only do we have guarantors operating, but some of our forums, again, those that are sophisticated, have guarantor services, et cetera, will even provide product reviews and testing. And that affects all the transactions. You might think, why would a forum provide a check or a validation process for sellers? Because they want everyone to be satisfied. And this is just an example of one forum's checking process. Checking your goods takes place voluntarily or if the administrator of the forum requires it. So it is optional. Checking is done by one specific person. The check takes from 1 to 3 days. After the check, the moderator guarantees there will be no stupid flames in the topic, like what we showed earlier where the person's trying to argue no, they're a legitimate vendor. The moderator will write a review on this and close the topic. If a requirement to provide your product for testing is refused, you risk being banned and your announcement erased. So, either you play or you don't. If you don't and you're asked to play, then this runs the risk of you being kicked out of the board. No money's taken for testing. This is very interesting because unlike guarantor services or escrow payments, the forum's completely doing this out of the, shall we say, goodness of their heart for all participants involved. They want to make sure everyone is satisfied with the outcome. You provide the product for the test in the same configuration in which you sell it. So you give it to us exactly as you would give it to the buyer. A good review is going to go a long way because it demonstrates that you're trustworthy. And in some cases, forums will actually designate an individual as a verified seller, a verified vendor of a specific product. That's the type of person you know you want to go to because they're not going to cheat you. They're not going to rip you off. So this creates an additional layer of complexity. And when we think about all of the encounters, not only do we have the potential for checking and testing, but our best forums also had a good degree of administrative oversight. In that case, forums would actively go in and disrupt or remove vendors on the basis of negative feedback. This is just one example of a forum's rules about how individuals get banned or blocked, or how complaints are processed. In this case, they say that if you leave fictitious rules in the topics, If a transaction's been carried out, it has to be confirmed. If you leave a fictitious review, you'll be banned, perhaps even permanently. What they're saying is you can't just come in and junk up a thread and make complaints. They have to be validated and true. In some cases, they're going to want you, as they say here, to post logs proving guilt. And what they're saying is they want the ICQ logs of your conversation with the person. They want to see how exactly it went down. You can't just say this person's a ripper or a ripoff artist. You've got to provide validation. And the last point, reviews from users with 1 to 10 messages who've not been on the forum for long will be deleted at the discretion of the moderator. That means if you're a seller, you can't just create 5 accounts and say, this guy's great, I've worked with him before, love his products, because those will be removed. This has an important implication. In some of the recent publications regarding how we might disrupt stolen data markets, some people have argued for a Sybil attack procedure, where you go in and just start posting tons and tons of reviews, comments, feedback, anything that junks up the thread and makes it hard for sellers to interact and buyers to know who to trust. A Sybil attack is only probably going to be effective in those disorganized forums. The ones that are heavily managed will figure out what's going on and block the individual, block the account. If you're doing it from a specific computer, that computer itself might even be banned. So better organized forums may not be disrupted by a Sybil attack. If it is effective, it will probably only be for a short period of time. So we have to think critically about what we're going to do to affect a disorganized market. And that leads us to a final point in thinking about organization. We have individuals who are working in a collegial fashion to engage in transactions. We have a peer process where individuals are being reviewed, vetted, tested, challenged. At a macro level, where we divorce ourselves sort of from the individual transactions and think about the high-level interactions, instead we're dealing with what we might think of as formal organizations. A moderator or a group of individuals who runs a site provide a place for people to buy and sell data. They also offer a good degree of managerial structure that is, to an extent, hierarchical. And there are interconnections between our forums. Some of the better vendors would say, I advertise on the following sites, you can see my reviews there, as a way of demonstrating I am trustworthy and reputable. So this kind of cross-forum interaction is important. And then finally, their duration over time. In 4 of our forums cases, we had posts over a 5-year window. And if you look at the date of an individual's first post, some of them went back to 2004. So we're talking about a long period of time where some of the groups have been active. And that's a very important thing when we're thinking about market disruption. If you've got a group that's been active for almost a decade, they might be more difficult to disrupt than one that's been active for 2 or 3 months, or one that's come up and then goes away. So there's a definitive difference in the types of markets that we see. What I'll do now is transition away from the organizational issues and talk for just a moment about the economic impact of the markets. We've talked about pricing, we've talked about the way in which products are bought and sold. So let's take just a second and look at the potential money that people might make. There's a lot of data being sold. Well, how much can an individual reasonably make? In order to come to these conclusions, since we can't necessarily know how many transactions were successfully completed, what we've done is added up all positive and negative feedback that an individual received. Now, that of course has some potential for error because there could be fictitious reviews, there could be false positives in the data. But this is at least one potential way to understand how many instances of a transaction took place. As you can see with dumps, we had 190 instances of transactions from our non-ripping forums and 67 in our ripping forums. So a total of 257 dumps instances of dumps transactions that took place. We had 63 for CVVs, the majority of them coming from our ripping forums, reinforcing that data point from earlier. On bank accounts, the majority again come from ripping forums, but for eBay and PayPal accounts, we saw 6 from non-ripping boards and 3 from ripping forums. So this gives us some degree of an understanding of how many transactions might have taken place. Another problem that comes up, though, is that this excludes anyone who didn't have a product review. They may have had no feedback. It could be that they actually had transactions, but we just didn't capture the product reviews in our data points. So there's some potential for bias and error, and I'll talk about how we tried to correct that in just a second. Taking those metrics, we've tried to overlay a couple of different pricing metrics. thinking about the average cost for data and the total number of transactions that take place. With our dump sellers, many of them specified that they wanted to sell data in large amounts. In some cases, their minimum quantity buy might have been 100. So we tried to set up some baselines for how many pieces an individual might have purchased in the course of a transaction. For dumps, we took 100 dumps per transaction. Taking the average cost for dumps, that's $102. If you're buying 100 dumps, your price might be $10,260. For CVVs, taking 50, that gives an average transaction cost of $1,310. For eBay and PayPal accounts, thinking again about 50, that gives us $1,362.50 average. If we multiply the number of transactions by the amount of money that we expect has taken place, this gives us some pretty dramatic estimates for profit. In the case of dumps, we're looking at $2,636,000. That's a staggering amount of money. That, of course, leads to the potential that there is no way your math is right on that. You could argue that. And so if we take the mean, or pardon me, if we take the median price for dumps, not the mean, that's $40. At that rate, just for dumps, we're still looking at $1 million in total transactions. Now, if we want to throttle that a little bit and say, all right, you're probably getting false positives. If we only take 65% of the feedback that was received, that drops the estimate down a little bit. That puts us at somewhere in the neighborhood of, depending on which amount we take, $668,000 or $1,713,000. So we're still talking about a substantial profit for dumps sellers. The important thing to note here is that we're not disaggregating rippers from non-rippers either. This means how much money any one vendor could make. This gives us a total economic estimate. We could run this a couple of different ways, but this is just a potential for loss that we wanted to highlight. So sellers could make a substantial amount of money. We might argue, in fact, that this is a seller's market, because when we take the total number of buyers who provided positive feedback, that's going to give us a different sense of how things go. For non-ripping dumps, we only had 117 instances of positive feedback. In our ripping forums, only 24 people had a satisfactory encounter. So there's a pretty substantial difference in what individuals report. Buyers are not going to come out as good when we compare it against, say, dumps vendors. And what I'll do now is provide something that might be even more salacious. Let's just try to figure out how much money a prospective dumps buyer might make. Now, if you've ever read any of the Ponemon reports, you know that they provide a potential loss metric per person. It's $188 in the in the 2013 report, but it varies from time to time. What we've tried to do here is take an amount reported by the Bureau of Justice Statistics for identity theft victimization. For credit card losses in 2012, victims reported an average loss of $1,448. The median, though, was only $300. When we compare it against debit card losses, we're talking about $500 versus $200. So there is some difference. Let's just think about the return on investment for dumps for a dumps buyer then. If we had 117 instances of positive feedback, let's assume for just a second, trying to throttle the amounts that they receive, that only 65 cards that they buy are valid. And depending on what metric you want to use, this creates a lot of different outcomes. But if we take the credit card loss average, we're looking at about $94,000 in gain per transaction, so about an 8 on the ROI. If we take the median, the ROI drops dramatically. But buyers have the potential, if we're using the median loss amount, to gain somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,281,000, which isn't bad, but it's not as good as what we might see with regard to dumps vendors. If we take the debit card amount using the median loss, we're looking at buyers acquiring somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 million. So it's a different type of metric depending on what you do. Thinking strategically, well, maybe dumps aren't the way to go. Let's just take the eBay and PayPal example for a moment. Let's assume that 25 pieces that you buy from an eBay or PayPal vendor are active. The ROI is way better in these instances than it is for other types of transactions. In this case, it could be $36,000 per transaction using the credit card loss average, or $13,000 if we use the debit card loss average. So there are some dramatic differences here, and it would strike most people, hopefully in the audience, that the better way to go in these markets is to be a vendor and not a buyer, because at least you're going to always make a profit, whether or not your data works. Some rube who buys from you may not know that you're disreputable, but they're going to pay you anyway. So this economy is one that's very, very complicated. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I'm going to have to skip over the social network analysis portion, but if you're interested in this, please let me know and we can talk about it a little bit more in depth later. Generally, what's the takeaway from all of this? When we think about the markets themselves, they are organized in a unique fashion. At the individual level, we're talking about a process where we're seeing peers and colleagues. At the formal forum level, we're seeing a more formal organization that takes place. The variation in terms of market sophistication would tell us that overall these markets are insufficient. We're going to see different individuals acting based on their status, based on what they're told, based on forum moderators or administrators. When we think about market disruption, given all of this, it's probably going to be a more effective strategy if we're thinking from a law enforcement perspective or from a more strategic point of view. The better way to go after these markets, based on how they're organized, is to take out the entire forum. Given the number of dumps vendors and different product sales that take place, one individual can jump in and take over another person's share of the market. So we have to think critically, how do we affect individuals? A one-on-one basis removal is not going to work. Sybil attacks are going to fail most likely in the better organized forums. So instead, something like a dark market procedure, where law enforcement or some entity sets up and runs the entire forum, taking out an entire site is going to make a much more dramatic impact than just occasionally removing a seller. Finally, another alternative strategy might be to try to go after the payment processors that are used. Taking out Liberty Reserve, for instance, has had some chilling effect on the market. It's very, very short term, but it's going to make an impact because that means they have to transition to a whole other service. That, of course, raises a lot of challenges, but it is an alternative venue that may have a longer effect on market disruption. In general, this is something that we could look at in a much, much more broad perspective. But with all the data that we have, one of the most important things that I can tell you from all of this is the need for greater participation and collaboration. As an academic, we're only getting one half of the pie. We can see what goes on in markets, but we can't see the individual exchanges between people outside of the forums. If we could set up better relationships with law enforcement and with industry, we could get a whole different perspective on what's going on. For instance, if we could have a direct partnership with law enforcement or with industry partners, we could look at trying to disrupt a full-bore market and do some actual evaluation. So the time that a site goes down, we could start looking for where people go to. This idea of displacement. If you take out a market, individuals who are interested are going to go somewhere else. Where do they go and how quickly do they move there? We can assess disruption and what it does to the markets in a broad way. We can also get some of those external communications through ICQ or other mediums, and we can do different processes of analysis with that information. In general, we're going to try to do a lot more with this data. We'd like to go through and compare our economic stuff against our social network analyses and see what's going on. We're going to go through IRC channels and a few other sites and try to create an even larger data set. And we'd like to go through and do some comparisons against sites that were recently taken out or some of the dead boards and compare them between what we see in more active markets. So there's a lot that we can do from here. With that in mind, I'll just go ahead and stop. Does anybody have any questions? Yes, sir. Sure. The question is, for people who are selling credit reports, what are they actually offering? What we saw were people offering credit report services, so they would do checks, not credit report dumps. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
What was the average age of the accounts? So, like, sellers and buyers?
You asked what was the average age of accounts. No one necessarily provided us with that information, so we couldn't tell without actually buying the data. Any other questions? Yes, sir. So if I understand correctly, the question is, what do sellers do to review moderators?
No.
Gotcha. So the question is, how do sellers get into the market? How do they operate? The better organized forums will stipulate the terms for a transaction, or at least how things should go. They can't guarantee you have to work that way. Sellers have the ability to say, I'm going to do this, not that. So there is some variation that is allowed at the individual level. But generally speaking, the disorganized boards in our site were like the Wild West. You could do whatever you wanted. So there's no necessary reason why someone would have to act a certain way. Since it's getting a little loud, if anybody else has any other questions, come on up, or I can go to the chill out room and we can set things up that way. Thank you.